Hey, welcome to the Creative Career Starter Podcast. My name is Chris Lyons, and I'm so glad to have you with me. Today, I'll be talking with David Nardone, a multidisciplinary creative based in Denver, Colorado. David started his career as a designer at Moxie Sozo in Boulder, and then he moved to Vail Resorts in Colorado in the travel and tourism space. And then he found his way to Chieftain, which is a cannabis design agency specializing in design, branding, and creative strategy for the cannabis industry. And now he's at Bellrock Brands in Denver, managing packaging, marketing, sales tool, and even product development. Get inside that a little bit. We'll talk to David about what he does, including the regulatory complexity of it all, how he got where he is, and what he looks for in young talent when he's reviewing a portfolio. David, how are you?
I am doing well, Chris. Good to be here. How are you doing?
I couldn't be better. It's so great to connect with you again. It's been way too long.
It's been too long.
I have a million questions for you, and I'm really interested in this category for design, and I know a lot of my students are as well. I'm trying to give my listeners a sense for as many different kinds of design experiences as I can think of. And I just spoke with Phil Chopla, who's the lead designer at Pinterest. Then I spoke with John Sensabaugh, who's the lead designer at The Athletic, and spoke with Jared Unger recently from the Federal Reserve. There are so many ways a career can go, and I would love to examine your success in the cannabis industry.
Excellent. Well, I'm happy to talk about it.
So you left school ages ago now with a beautiful book of illustration-driven design. How did you find your way to where you are right now?
Oh, wow. Well, I guess, like you said, I moved out here for an opportunity at Moxie Sozo, which is a reputable design agency known for using a lot of illustration in their executional designs, but mostly packaging. So I was always drawn to that, you know, always wanted to explore more of that. And I thankfully landed that opportunity to come out here and do that. And then, you know, if I'm to continue on, like you said, went to Vail Resorts, which, you know, it's a large corporation in the travel industry, travel and entertainment, because, you know, they compete with the likes of Disney and such for family dollars. But, you know, they own several mountains across the globe, really. And then, you know, from there, I took the jump to the cannabis industry. It was a risk at the time. This is a new industry at the time, and it was just kind of uncertain how, you know, my career would play out taking a risk like that. I took a pay cut to jump over to the cannabis industry, but I saw a need there and wanted to go in that direction. I never looked back.
So what made you think you could be successful in this category?
So, you know, cannabis has always been a part of my creative process, a part of me. You know, obviously the stigma that came with it, the stoner culture and everything made it so, you know, people didn't really want to talk about, you know, admit that they use. But to me, it was just intriguing because here we are with an industry that just should naturally pair with art. You know, art, illustration, it goes naturally with cannabis. And, you know, at this time I was looking in the back of our local magazines where they would, you know, hold the ads for dispensaries and whatnot. And it's funny because the ads I saw in there are just, it looks like, and I always picture this in my head, like some slob in their basement just, you know, getting grease all over their keyboard as they design these ads that just are trying to fit in their company information around the price per ounce. And there's no art, no anything, poorly designed. And that's what kind of struck me is this industry needing help. So yeah, that's kind of what inspired me to jump over, is the opportunity to kind of lead the charge forward. You know, with removing the stigma that cannabis had in this industry in order for it to, you know, propel forward and gain respect among a community who largely doesn't respect it.
I think you've experienced the mainstreaming of the cannabis industry from, to your point, some guy in a garage with greasy fingers to now really high-end design. Some of the edible packaging is absolutely beautiful. It's gone from, you know, garage works to the penthouse.
I mean, that's really it. You know, early on, Colorado was the first state to, you know, first open its doors to recreational cannabis sales in 2014. Amendment 64 was passed in 2012. 2 years later, in 2014, is when they rolled it out. And, you know, around that time, I mean, you have people coming in this industry starting businesses from all different facets, right? Some are marketing savvy and some are not marketing savvy. And that's where they, you know, rely heavily on design and marketing and the intellect of others to help run their business. But even then, you know, packaging itself was very sterile because they were trying to appeal to a wide audience at the time, maybe a little timid about identifying, you know, and create an identity for themselves as a brand, you know, because they think that they're going to, you know, leave out a demographic or exclude consumers that they could possibly have. So it was very sterile. And that's what I thought was so fascinating about it. I mean, there's a strategy behind it, you know, open your doors to a lot of people. But then when a lot of manufacturers started coming in the space, or a lot of dispensaries, the only way to differentiate yourself from others is by brand, like any industry. So that's when they were kind of forced to start to look to differentiate themselves and figure out, hey, I need some better branding here. I can't just have a green cross on the side of my building and expect people to drop in.
Yeah, I think the maturation of the industry demanded that, because now there's so much competition. And I'd love you to talk about is the demographics that you have to appeal to.
There's so many people. I mean, there's on one end, let's call them just your stoners looking to get high, which is totally fine. And then on the other end are people who actually need this plant to live day to day. And I don't say that lightly, because I have several stories and testimonials from consumers who just have ailments with names I can't even pronounce. And they're on several pills a day. And, you know, they take something like a tincture or sublingual, and it helps them. It reduces how many pills they have to take. Even back in the beginning, you know, a lot of families were moving here because they have children with epilepsy and, you know, needed the medicine for their kids. And when I saw how cannabis was able to just completely stop a child from seizing, it changed my life. And just from the outside, you know, I mean, I'm sure it obviously changed their life. But that's when I knew, you know, that we needed to reform this and legalize it, you know, across the country. It's a plant that is miraculous. And I think that's sometimes the things we forget here is what we're actually about. You know, we have a 420 celebration here every year in Colorado, and it became, you know, a big thing. But sometimes it's forgot what we're actually celebrating, and we're celebrating the liberation of this plant. And, you know, we have to make sure that we do right by that, you know, and act as a community that, you know, like I said, propels this into the future and helps, you know, the perception of the plant, and others will come on board and understand why we're actually fighting for what we're fighting for.
I think when you consider it as a natural alternative to some of these heavy duty pharmaceuticals that people get so addicted to and have caused so much distress and pain in this country, and you think about this plant that is now manufactured or produced with the ability to be about sleep or be about focus or be about relaxation in a natural way, it's astonishing to me that it took this long.
Yeah, and it's still developing. And, you know, from someone who lost multiple friends to the opioid epidemic, it's become a passion of mine. It's become more than, hey, I'm designing a cool weed leaf. You know, and a lot of people in the industry are like that, you know, that they're in it for one reason or another. I mean, this gets, you know, it touches politics. It touches society. It touches some deep topics, like the war on drugs and people getting jailed, you know, and with ridiculous sentences. And like you said, the pharmaceutical dominance in our society. I mean, there's people in this industry that it's their life. They're fighting for something. It's not just, you know, hey, I want to smoke weed. There's something that bubbles to the surface in this industry. And, you know, that's why I'm very thankful. I mean, like anything, when you're able to find, you know, something you're passionate about and link it with something you're good at doing, you know, I just feel very fortunate for the position I'm in right now.
In my past few podcasts, I've spoken with some designers who've been lucky enough to match up the thing they love to do with the thing they do every day at their job. And that's, I think, where the magic happens. And in your case, David, I would suggest that you really have a big responsibility on your shoulders to message this in a way that destigmatizes it and makes it more palatable to have in the house, to have with friends, to make it, I don't want to say mainstream, but it's kind of what it is.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I want to think about, you know, your audience here for a bit. And it's kind of like anything else. You know, I mean, my path, my career path has led me here. And there's a lot of things that I've learned along the way, you know, in any career that primes me to be ready for this opportunity when it comes to, you know, figuring out a marketing messaging and the different consumer touch points, or, you know, sales, you know, what's going to hit with the buyers and the consumers. You know, there's multiple facets within this industry. So you're speaking to a lot of different people. You know, there's really no one here to tell us how to do this, or to tell me how to do this.
Right.
I think a little bit of what you're touching on. I mean, I work with, you know, research and development to understand the complexities of the plant, you know, as they're developing them. There, you know, there's some scientific papers out there, but a lot of this research is new and developing, and, you know, companies are in a race to try and be first to develop it, bring it first to market. But you want to make sure you're bringing a safe product to market, you know, and there's things you can say and things you can't say about it. You know, I talked about earlier, and we can dive into regulation, but we're not allowed to talk about testimonials of how our product helped people. And, you know, you might think, why the hell not? That's crazy. I agree. It is crazy. We should be able to disclose this information to others who need it. And, you know, I think the fight is still going on in that sense. When regulatory bodies come in, think they know, you know, they're putting in laws that they think are helping to protect, but really they're just doing more damage.
What was the explanation for that? Why would they disallow case studies?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And, you know, it's really because it's not FDA approved, and these, you know, the research is so new. So I think it's because it doesn't go through whatever normal process it goes through, even though it's, hey, I have, you know, 30 people over here saying it helps them with this. Why can't I tell our other consumers? Why can't I put on my website? It doesn't really make any sense.
So you've got this immovable object, which is the federal government, then you've got states' rights. How do you talk about the regulatory complexity of this?
It is complex. You know, it's especially since this is an illegal substance that became legal, what, 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago now in Colorado. And now just because of the, you know, COVID and everything, they determined it was an essential business. So it went from being an illegal substance to an essential business in, you know, 6 years time, but still it's federally illegal. I mean, we can talk about this all day, but we're going to find that, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's complex because, you know, they also are happy to take, the federal government's happy to take tax money from it. So there's, you know, complexities there. But as far as regulation, just from state to state, you know, it goes deep. It goes for manufacturing. A lot of MIPS, or, you know, marijuana infused product companies, they try to do things by the book. You know, some follow the FDA guidelines on ingredients, you know, even the facility itself. They want to make sure they're up to code and ready for when this thing does go federally legal. So there's a lot of anticipation there, a lot of compliance that happens even when it's not mandated. But, you know, even just from packaging, package to package, it changes. Each state is different. So, like, other, it would kind of be the equivalent to operating in multiple countries, you know, in different industries where, hey, the country has their own, you know, body of regulation. Where here, each state has its own body of regulation. And some are similar and some are not, you know. So I have to look at things like font sizes on the packaging. Some say a 16th of an inch, which you go to figure out it's 4.5 font. You can't go smaller than 4.5 font. Some are 6-point font. You know, you can't go smaller than that. Some you have to say cannabis infused. You know, the word cannabis might have to be bold and bigger, you know, than the name of your product. Some you can't even show imagery. You can't show fruits. You know, you can't show illustration. It's all over the place. So that's why, I don't know, I find it fascinating and it's complex, and I love solving complex riddles, but it can't get much more difficult, really, than this industry.
But you're a first mover. I mean, you have been in this from the start. I think you're positioned really nicely to just introduce classic marketing and branding and sales tools to the industry that probably really needs them.
And that yeah, really brings it back to, you know, your original point of, you know, what do I do here? It's really needed, you know. People are figuring it out. Like I said, people are figuring it out. They don't really know what will hit with their consumers. So the value that I provide to a lot of, you know, my clients is just guiding them in that messaging, the marketing messaging, being authentic in this space. You know, I think we have a savvy consumer here who has been consuming this product for a long time. Others are new, but, you know, you really have to be authentic in this space. Some traditional marketing tactics are not going to work and they're going to be sniffed out. So, I try to guide my clients in an authentic way, you know, putting out a message that aligns with their brand and speaks to what they do.
Is there any learning to be had from the microbrew industry and how they have had to go so regional and differentiate themselves based on what? On the brewer's innate knowledge of the ingredients and the audience? Are there parallels?
Oh yeah, there's definitely parallels. You know, I think just as a business, you know, there are a lot of small businesses popping up, a lot of mom and pop shops, you know, where they at this time in the industry weren't afraid to create an identity. And like I said, it's that identity that's going to attract a niche consumer. And I think that's, you know, aligns with microbrews. You know, you just put yourself out there and you have, you know, you do cool packaging or whatever. You can take some more leeway with what you do, you know, and it attracts a certain type of demographic. You know, they're connoisseurs of the brew. And just like that, I mean, you'll find connoisseurs, we like to call them canisseurs in the cannabis industry. But, you know, they know what they're talking about. And a lot of growers, too. I mean, they know what they're doing. It's a science. It's an art form. So there's been a lot of education, you know, that I've had to go through. And like I said before, talking with research and development, I talk with sales to understand, you know, what's happening in the market, what's hitting, what's not hitting, in order to guide design, to guide that marketing message and inform. And like I said, there's no one here to tell us how to do this. So I there's been times where, yes, I've been working on a project or a booklet to, you know, put in the dispensaries so the consumer can read, but I'm learning about what I'm trying to educate on. You know, it's like, we want to talk about cannabinoids and what they are, that everyone has a cannabinoid system, endocannabinoid system in their body. So cannabis was meant for us, you know, and like, that might be a surprise to some people in the audience, but this is the level of knowledge that designers, I would say, need to have if you're going to be able to make the impact that, we should be making in this industry. It's taking complex information about the plant and educating the consumer so they can have a better idea of what this is.
All right. So that brings me to, what most of my listeners find to be the most useful portion of the show here. What does a young designer need to do to present themselves as a viable candidate to work at a cannabis design firm?
There weren't too many, and there still aren't too many cannabis-specific firms. And, like I said, we did that at Chieftain. But it's because, the industry, they wanted to hire from within. The authenticity. They knew that we were here for the plant, to market the plant. We're educated about the plant. So that was kind of the, allure of working with a cannabis-specific agency. And you might find those out there, but I think the same foundational tools are needed in design. As a designer, you need to have the same skill sets that you would really anywhere else.
So as it relates to young talent, David, is proximity and location an important characteristic in the hiring process?
Yeah, that's a good question. It kind of is important because we want you to be here. We want you to be able to walk in a dispensary and experience what that's like. It is a unique thing. I remember being a little nervous my first time going into a dispensary and not knowing what to expect, but it's a very friendly and welcoming experience. And you just should step in there and look around, see what's, being advertised to you, how the packaging looks. There's definitely regulation within the dispensaries themselves of what they can display, how they can display it. So knowing that is important. And I think as industry develops and matures, location becomes important in that sense, because other states that pop up and legalize who aren't legal yet will be looking for talent from the original states, Colorado, California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Michigan just popped up recently. They'll be looking for seasoned talent, to come on and take over their operation. So I think poaching is going to be a big thing from, state to state until this goes federally legal. So that's, where I think location might be a little more important.
All right. So when you're looking at young designers' books, what gets your attention?
Myself personally, I've looked at hundreds of resumes over the years. I was actually thrown in the fire and tasked with hiring interns and young designers when I was just a youngin' myself at Moxie Sozo. So I've had a lot of experience looking through resumes and portfolios and have kind of created a system for myself that I think might that I'd like to share that would help educate on kind of what I'm looking for immediately. So immediately with a resume, I'm looking for layout skills. Is your resume, is it overall pleasing and is it functional? Can I find the information I'm looking for? Design is obviously the cross between form and function. So your resume should exude that. I also have just a firm belief that layout design is a foundational and required skill that is needed to build up everything on top of. And I don't know if it's because I, came a little bit from the editorial world. I worked on a magazine that I was a creative director of at Moxie Sozo. So I kind of built that foundation, but I just realized how important it is because you can't really design a digital ad or, a sales sheet or any sort of collateral without typography skills and layout design. So first and foremost, that's what I'm looking for. Attention to detail. If there's misspellings, I just might toss it out and not even move forward because that just tells me you have a lack of attention to detail or you didn't put time into this and this is the thing that speaks about you. I actually just saw a resume recently that had no contact information on it. I remember back when I was a young lad in your class, Chris, you put the fear in us when you said people will pin up your terribly designed resume on the board and kind of crack at it. Some of the other things I could speak on, I do look at school. That's not to say that school determines the caliber of designer you are. but I've become, you know, looking at so many resumes, I've become familiar with the type of designers or the level of education that they receive at particular schools, you know. But despite that, I'm really looking at does this resume look nice? That tells me if you can design or not right off the bat. You know, moving on, if all is well there, I'll move on to the portfolio. You know, hopefully I can click right on that link in the PDF. You know, it's funny, thinking about that a little bit, how much attention we pay to physical portfolio books. But now we've come such a long way in the digital age, where things move fast. And, you know, I'll copy it, you know, I'll highlight, copy and paste your portfolio address and plug it in there. But, you know, you're one step away from me just skipping it. So make sure you put a link, make it clickable. But then I'll move on to the portfolio. And, you know, I'm looking at the website. Is it clean? Is it simple? Is it easy to navigate? Does it match your resume? You know, the type of work. Like I said, I'm looking for foundational work. I look for layout design. I look for brand identity. It's a good tell, you know, can you develop an identity system, logos, and then, you know, collateral that matches and executional elements that all is part of a system. Because that, you know, that is design. Design is everything. It has to be translatable across many applications and executions. Sure, packaging, if it's applicable, if I'm looking for someone with packaging skill, it's always nice to see a good package, because that's where, you know, in my mind, you're really mixing everything. You're mixing art with layout design, with the need for hierarchy, for information, marketing messaging, you know, on the bottle or package or whatever it may be, because you need to grab that consumer's eye. So you're also thinking about the package in its environment. And I think about that with any kind of application, whether it's a billboard or a digital ad, the designer must think about the environment that this particular piece is being viewed in.
So they make it past those two gates, and you've got now an in-person or via Zoom interview. Tell me what wins the day in that case.
Oh, yeah. Good question. It really depends. I mean, what the fit you're looking for. You know, someone for a young designer, someone who's, you know, humble, eager to learn, you know, they'll keep their eyes and ears open. You know, I just remember my first years at Moxie, I just kept my head down, worked hard, and it eventually got noticed. There's obviously going to be some challenges along the way, but I think that's where you start to build your identity for yourself and start to know what you want. So don't get too caught up in trying to figure things out all at once. You know, a career is a long journey, and it's not only a journey for what you do. I think it's a journey for yourself. You know, you're developing your own being within these roles and knowing where you want to go from there.
And that's great. Speaking of humility, if I recall correctly, first few months of your professional life where you were couch surfing.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, my story is, yeah, I sold what I had. So I had some gas money to move out here, you know, for this internship that was unpaid at the time, and couch surfed for about 8 months or so until I was able to, you know, get paid for what I was doing and get my feet under me. But I was willing to do, you know, what it takes. They kind of called it an apprenticeship. Yeah. You know,
that'll keep you humble, won't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. So put your time in, because your time will come. But it's just, now I got a story to tell.
Excellent. David, this was fabulous, your insights and your experience. And what's interesting to me is the category really is almost universal. It is design. It is creative problem solving, regardless of if you're working at the Federal Reserve or you're working at the Athletic or you're working in the cannabis industry. You are still, at the end of the day, you're a creative problem solver, right?
Yeah. I mean, that you summed it up nicely, and that's where I would, you know, bring it back to, is it your understanding. I mean, with any CPG company, like, you need to understand the product that you're selling, and you need to understand the market that you're selling to. And just in the cannabis space, you know, there's a lot of barriers and obstacles to navigate, and it's a new industry. So not all the information is out there for you. So it's a really, you know, go-getter industry. And for designers, we're problem solvers. We have to figure it out. And, you know, in my experience of talking to manufacturers, and then they sell their product to dispensaries, and then the dispensaries sell the product to consumers. You know, there's ancillary business on the outskirts of that. You know, I'm able to kind of see everything, and you have to be able to piece it together to know what to talk about and when to talk about it and where to talk about it.
Fantastic. David, thank you so much for your time today. This has just been a great conversation. I can't wait to get this out there.
Of course, Chris. Yeah, I hope it's been helpful. I know it's a, you know, there's not a lot of information out there on the cannabis industry. And I think as we continue forward, there will be, you know, a lot more talented designers that come in here and help change the space. But that's been exactly it. It's trying to mature the industry through design and, you know, allow everyone to see what cannabis truly is, you know, whereas before it was tied to another stigma. And now I think we have the opportunity to bring it to the forefront.
That's great. I think you're just the guy to do it, David.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris.
And next time you're in town, you call me and we stop at one of these nice little microbrews and we get ourselves a nice beer and talk it over.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you.
Many thanks to my guest, David Nardone, for joining us today. So much solid information. If you're looking to get your portfolio strengthened and shaped so it better reflects your career plans, I can help you. Send me an email to chris@creativecareerstarter.com and let's discuss the ways we can make that happen. Hey, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.